So, speaking of sermons, continuing my intermittent series on how ideas about the soul affect both individuals and society, I'll again start with a condensed view of what's come before, though since the series is getting longer, I can only touch on bits. So please remember that you can access audio recordings of prior installments on the UUCPA website if you like. In a nutshell, I've described how while the modern era has given humankind immense gifts, its dominant philosophy of materialism, which is not consumerist materialism, it is the philosophy of materialism, which holds that physical matter constitutes the whole of reality, has also purged any transcendent or transrational, that is, beyond the rational aspect from human life. And I've proposed that the resultant spiritual vacuum causes major personal and collective problems. And also, in agreement with mythologist Joseph Campbell, that archaic religious remedies, primarily meaning believe this or land in hell, Christianity and Islam, now mainly only aggravate these and related ills. Then drawing on Plato, there are other versions, but drawing on Plato, I offered a very different transrational template from those of traditional religions. The main points are that human beings indeed have a soul and enter the world with a life blueprint and a personal calling and destiny, which, by the way, I will explicate on in future weeks. Plato also describes the soul's spirit companion, termed daimon, D-A-I-M-O-N, in Greek, and genius in Latin, that guides the soul during its earthly excursion. And further, that when people identify and live out this calling as wholeheartedly as possible, it's personally beneficial and potentially culturally transformative. My latest installments then broadly describe the historical emergence of materialism's soulless worldview, including the very understandable reasons this first became normalized, which was largely to break free of religious tyranny. I sum this up by observing that the same modern era cultural voyage that produced such enormous benefits has also wreaked unequaled devastation. A journey contemporary French cultural critic and philosopher Paul Virilio pithily captured in remarking that when you invent the ship, you also invent the shipwreck. I then focused on how some people can't seem to admit modernism's shipwreck side and contrasted this with how postmodernism's general willingness to consider multiple perspectives tends to foster better understanding of others' realities and thus empathy, which can then seek improvements, and that includes ecological improvements. As explained before, while there's no one definition of postmodernism, I'm using thinker and author Steve McIntosh's characterization of a more attentive and inclusive worldview that is, quote, comprised of the victims of modernity, including individual people, races, and cultures, and the overall natural environment, together with those who are sensitive to the pain of victimization, even though they may not have been directly victimized themselves. And I shared how from this worldview's emergence in the mid-20th century until today, this has fueled a culture war between those striving to foster a more equitable and sustainable planetary community based on universal moral regard for others and the Earth, and those determined, consciously or unconsciously, to retain their psychological equilibrium and or parochial power and privilege by zealously denying modernism's shadow side. Philosopher Immanuel Kant links an ethical outcome to the new awareness and ability now required of all humankind. For peace to reign on Earth, humans must evolve into new beings who have learned to see the whole first. Of course, that's whole with a W. Now, bringing all this back to the soul, I ended last week by saying that the postmodern worldview has indeed helped many more people see more of the whole and to some extent evolve accordingly. Yet for all its vision and heart-expanding possibilities and positives, it has its own troubling shadow and blinders, including to the existence of the human soul. Hence, I'll wrap up this section of our series for the summer with a look at these and why this worldview cannot form the transrational foundation for a profoundly evolutionary, soul-focused life. I'll begin with three summary never-before statements. Never before have the damages now being inflicted by modernism's Titanic, small t, and potentially Titanic, capital T, as in the doomed vessel, shadow been anywhere close to this order of magnitude. Never before has it been so vital to see the whole and include those long excluded and exploited by that shadow, in part by honoring and applying postmodernism's, in cultural historian Richard Tarnas's words, appreciation of both the multidimensional complexity of reality and the plurality of perspectives necessary to approach it. And never before have blinkered denialist, there is no shadow, and by the way, move those deck chairs, claims to the contrary been so shrill and rung so morally hollow and been so observably baseless. But as I said, to various degrees, postmodernism has its own troubling shadow, which for our purposes has two main parts: not enough gratitude and no solid ground. The first arises when postmodern critics fail to acknowledge modernism's colossal achievements and bounteous benefits, and conveniently forget or ignore that these established the material and institutional foundations that largely enable them to formulate and express their critical appraisals at all. Especially when coupled with a too common sardonic smugness, this only hardens resentment among those who provided these and fuels denialist resolve to maintain the status quo. It would be both more accurate and more effective to honor modernity's achievements and retain the best of what's been produced, while yet recognizing that any tree that won't release its dying leaves can no longer bear good fruit. The second aspect, shadow aspect, is even more problematic. For what Richard Tarnas just said about multiple angles being needed to even approach reality is true, as is the postmodern precept I noted earlier, that unconscious elements inevitably distort our attempts to be objective to some degree. But Tarnas also points out that postmodern thought can take this too far, convincing itself that our knowledge of the world can never be more than a subjective rendering, as he says, ever-shifting, free-floating, ungrounded in an objective reality. As a result, he says, here abridged, the modern blindness to its own posture was precisely what many postmodern thinkers sought to correct. Yet in doing so, the postmodern strategy tended to produce an even more absolute negation. All reality perceived as nothing more than a social-linguistic construct. Every attempt at a larger coherence, every discernment of an underlying spiritual meaning or purpose was fundamentally suspect. Every imagination of a larger significance drew deconstructive forces towards it like heat-seeking missiles. This denial of our inborn spiritual coherence is postmodernism's central disimaginative blinder. So despite its important expansion of consciousness and care to a planetary level, reprising Houston Smith's phrase, it still contributes to the same debilitating abnormal condition for the human spirit, as does modernism, because at root, it mostly inhabits the same materialist paradigm. Certainly, it opened the West to additional spiritual vistas, which has also been invaluable, if at times a bit kaleidoscopically perplexing, to many, including me. But as historian and sociologist Lewis Mumford notes, here abridged, every transformation of humanity has rested upon a new vision of the cosmos and the nature of the human. And since postmodernism largely retains modernism's soulless status for both, that is, both cosmos and human, it's like a firm that implodes aging, dilapidated buildings. Its deconstruction of modernism has cleared new ground and revealed more of Kant's necessary ethical whole. But it can't fully evolve humans into new beings because it's still closed to the orienting and vitalizing inner wholeness of the soul. It remains disenchanted, the term one of social science founders Max Weber used for modern scientism's expulsion of the, quote, mysterious and incalculable from human beings and the world. Thus, postmodernism can't supply a truly reimagined transformational foundation upon which to build a fully integrated life, much less a transformed and, per Kant, peaceful civilization. Future talks will begin with another compelling account of the transrational soul-focused framework that can. But for now, a concluding two-part thought from mythologist Michael Mead encapsulates what I've been addressing these last few weeks. By the way, I also shared bits of this last October when I looked at the nature of change and varied responses to it. It begins with a message applicable to those who can't or won't admit to modernism's shipwreck aspects, and thus the need to change anything. Because underneath all the disimaginative denialism and deceitful othering, all the unrighteous rage and hate mongering is always inordinate fear, writes Mead. Change is the essence of life, but as people face great changes and an unknown future, they tend to become fearful. As fear spreads, most try to cling to something familiar and try to control things in order to reduce the terror of being overwhelmed. Yet the overwhelming lesson of history on both collective and individual levels is that closing down and holding tight to familiar things does not work. In the dens of disimagination, this fear manifests as nothing so much as trying to control everything and everyone by closing down, including the creative imagination, and holding tight, now to the point of a planetary near-death grip. But all this effort to cling to the familiar can only result in a paralyzed and petrified, meaning both fearful and ossified, pseudo-security, all the while detrimentally impeding the evolutionary changes now required. And to not minimize the scope of those changes, Richard Tarnas, here abridged by me, highlights the scale of our between times historical setting. We are living in one of those rare ages, like the end of classical antiquity or the beginning of the modern era, that bring forth, through great stress and struggle, a genuinely fundamental transformation in the underlying assumptions and principles of the cultural worldview. The outcome of this tremendous moment in our civilization's history is deeply uncertain. Something is dying, and something is being born. The stakes are high for the future of humanity and the future of the earth. Given this, it's understandable that we might resonate with journalist Edward R. Murrow's quip that anyone who isn't confused doesn't really understand the situation. Which here we could tweak to anyone who isn't unsettled. And no wonder. Yet in the midst of this great stress and struggle, high-stakes transitional age, organizational development expert William Bridges affirms a timeless truth. It is only in between, when the old ways disintegrate and the new ways haven't yet taken shape, that creative answers can be discovered. Which brings us to the second part of Mead's statement, where he says, amid such massive disorientation, one of the few ways to find sense and meaning is to find the inner order, the shape and style of one's own soul. As I said, when I reopen our soul focus explorations, it will be with another absorbing destiny moment story of a person finding their soul's shape and style. I'll then count more collective costs of what's been lost through our current spiritually insolvent state of disenchantment before turning fully to how to begin cultivating a soulful life that honors and includes its mysterious and incalculable aspects, and how finding one's inner order and reclaiming the transformative and orienting transrational energy of our soul's calling can help restore individual and communal well-being to our troubled in-between world. For as Mead also assures us, at the end of the world as we know it, the unseen world waits to be found again. Namaste and blessed be.